My word, how about a little bit of JT this morning? You know, you never know what you're going to get when you come to Crosspoint. I mean, it's just, you know, who would have thought Justin Timberlake, JT, we also have some officers around here named JT, just, you know, but this was awesome. Well, hey, great to have you here this morning. My name's Kurt. If we haven't had a chance to meet, it's great to meet you this morning. Great to have you here at Crosspoint. And as Vince said, we're in week number four of the series Slaying Giants. And this really came out of a bunch of men here this last spring went through something called Fight Club, which we do a couple times a year. And we read this book called Goliath Must Fall that talks about the giants in our life that we must slay. And for these men, through Fight Club, having to read this book, it really created a lot of sustainable change in us addressing some of the major things that grab onto our life and keep us from experiencing all that God has for us. So we saw it was so powerful, we thought we'd do a series out of it. So this series is kind of based on that book. Because the reality is, we all have giants in our lives. We all have adversaries that creep in, and sometimes we don't even know it, and these things begin to steal life from us and create insecurity, and they create false identity. And so today, we're going to look at this whole idea of the giant of anger. And I don't know about you, but it doesn't take me long to see the friction or the tension of anger playing out in my life. In fact, just this past week, I was driving with my daughter. In fact, my oldest daughter, Macy, just got her learner's permit, so she's driving us around town now. As much as possible. And last Sunday, we were coming home from lunch, and you know, Fishers is difficult to learn to drive. I don't know if you recognize that, but you know, when you're sitting with a new driver and you're going through roundabouts and double diamonds and all these things, it's difficult. And I had just gotten home from Kenya. We'd been in Kenya for 10 days, where you know the streets are packed, and our driver wouldn't even stop. He'd just blow right into an intersection full of people, full of cars, and everybody would make way without ever honking. We're very generous and kind. And so we get home, and she's driving, and she had a difficult moment through a couple roundabouts, so we got to a stop sign in our neighborhood, and I said, "Hey, Macy, just stop right here for a moment. Let me coach you through those before we get out of this moment." And I kid you not, we were sitting there maybe 2 seconds, and some idiot behind me was like, hopefully it was none of you, or maybe it is a good thing if it was one of you. He was like, he's like laying on his horn. And I about came unglued. I'm trying to have like a coaching moment with my daughter. And it's not like we'd been sitting there for very long at all. I turn around and Macy freaks out. She just goes. It's a four-way stop. I don't even know if she looks. She just goes. She's like, "Dad, I didn't know what to do." I'm so hacked off at the guy. He turns and comes behind us. I'm like gesturing at him out the back window. I don't advocate this, but I just about gave him a one-finger salute out the sunroof, and I'm not saying you should do that. I'm just telling you, I was so mad in that moment. And you know, and then he's trying to pass her on our neighborhood road. And fortunately, she was driving, because I would have stopped, and I don't know what I would have done. I don't know if I was gonna fight him or what was gonna happen, but she just kept going, and then he turned off, and I got home, and as I kind of cooled down, I thought to myself, what just happened right there? Because I'm a pretty reflective person, so I'm thinking through, okay, and I realized there was something way beyond just that moment that was going on underneath the surface. And this is oftentimes kind of how anger presents itself. I mean, I was shaking my fists out the back window and ranting and raving, and the kids are like, "Man, Dad, you were angry." But that was just a sign of something that was lurking underneath the surface. And so that's one of my stories. I'm sure you have some of yours. How many of us would say, out of curiosity, I'm an angry person sometimes, most of the time? Oh, yeah, you have some good self-aware. Most of you are lying in the room. But, you know, it's not surprising that most of us don't raise our hands, because if we were to say, "Hey, am I angry?" most of us go, "Well, no, I'm not like Kurt, that lunatic up there shaking his fists at people. You know, I don't like throw things or lash out at my spouse." But see, one of the things I want us to consider this morning is anger is something that deep beneath the kind of top level of our lives, the top layer of our lives, there's often a different story going on. You know, because sometimes anger emerges visibly, but a lot of times it's underneath the surface. It's a few layers down, just waiting for something to catalyze it and set it off. And so this is often where anger kind of presents itself in our lives. And so Giglio, in his book, he actually says this. He says, "This is why dealing with the giant of rejection is so important for us. Most anger is rooted in some form of rejection, something that was or wasn't said, something that was repeatedly done to us, something we deserved but were deprived of, a hurt, a wound, a stab." So big idea today, big thing I want us to go after is when we have unidentified anger in our lives, it actually can shut down the possibilities that God has for our lives. And so one of the things I want us to think about as we dive into this today is that anger in and of itself isn't necessarily wrong. All right, in fact, Ephesians 4, Paul talks about how in your anger, do not sin. And then in James, Jesus' brother James writes this. He says, everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. Even in the life of Jesus, we see Jesus at times getting angry. We see this powerful emotion come out of his life, and yet he does not sin in the midst of that emotion. And yet, you know, when Jesus is in the temple, he at one point kicks out all the money changers and kicks, he doesn't go up to these people in the temple and say, hey, I don't like how you're doing business. Could you please leave? He like flips their tables over. He's like, get out of here. He's angry. We see in Luke chapter 11, Jesus shows up at a party and he has some really insulting words for the host who's really discriminating against a group of people. And so Jesus gets angry. And what he shows us, though, is there's appropriate ways to express that, and then there's inappropriate ways. There's righteous things to be angry over, which we'll talk about another day. That's a message for another time. But today, I want us to see how oftentimes this anger kind of just bubbles up in our lives, and it becomes a problem because it takes over and ultimately takes us away from God's best in our lives. So there's three ways that the anger kind of evidences itself in our lives, and I want to just give them to you real quickly. The first is wrongly felt anger. Now, wrongly felt anger is when you are angry about something that hasn't happened yet, all right? When you go, well, I think she's going to say this about me, and you're angry at her because she might say something, or I think this is what he's going to do, and you're angry because of something that might happen, and so that's wrongly felt anger because you're angry over something that hasn't even happened. And then the second type of anger is rightly felt anger that's wrongly expressed, and we've all probably had this, where we there's something we should be angry about. I mean, when somebody's getting taken advantage of, when we see school shootings in our community, that should make us angry. That should make us very, very angry. And yet sometimes, even amidst an appropriate anger, we respond inappropriately. And so that's rightly felt anger that's wrongly expressed. And then the third type of anger is rightly felt anger that's never expressed. And this is where you get bent out of shape about something, and then somebody comes up and they're like, hey, you doing okay? And you're like, oh yeah, I'm fine. And you're never really truthful about what's going on inside of you. And so you repress your anger. And this is probably the most dangerous of all, because this is the anger that lurks beneath the surface, just waiting for that catalyst to set it off. Now, there's a million reasons we could be angry, right? All kinds of things, all the way from being angry at our boss to our ex-boss to, you know, the job that we don't like. We can be angry about, you know, something going on politically in our world or a whole political party or the president or our government or, you know, your church. You could be angry at your pastor. You could be angry at, you know, your neighbors for playing their music too loud or, you know, for not, you know, taking care of the yard the way you want. You could be angry at your parents. You could be angry at your adult parents. Kids, you could be angry at your parents. Parents, you could be angry at your kids. I mean, you could be angry at your spouse. There's a million reasons that we can be angry. And so I want us to do a little self-assessment before we go any further in this morning. And so in your weekly, as Vince said, there's this little survey that says naming the giant of anger. I want you to take that out. And I want you to grab the pen you received when you came in. I'm going to give you about a minute and a half to work through this. But I want you to just ask, you know, read these statements and mark any that apply to you. Because I want us to see if there's some anger that isn't just the things we're aware of, but maybe something lurking beneath the surface that might be going on in our lives. And so if you need to get up and grab one of these in the back, feel free. We've got extras. But take a moment and just read through this list and mark any that you feel pertain to your life. So as you're completing this, and you can keep working if you're not finished, I want you to ask yourself, you know, as I work through this, what sticks out to me? You know, what is it on this list that maybe bears the most weight? It's interesting, you might be going through this going, oh my gosh, I'm angry at a lot of things. I'm angry at life. You may have even discovered that you're angry at God, which is totally cool. It's actually a really good thing to identify that if that's the case. And he can handle it. You know, regardless of what you see on this list, and I want to encourage you to complete this if you haven't done so, here's the good news. The good news is that through the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, that anger has been taken down, right? The giant of anger has been killed. Now, it might still be, you know, rearing its head in your life. Anger still may be taunting you at times. It may still have deadly venom in its fangs, but the giant of anger has been taken down. And in fact, throughout this series, we've been taking a look, doing some kind of look-ins at the story of David and Goliath. And again, we'll do that today. And as we look at the life of David, we don't necessarily see inappropriate anger in David's life. David seems like a pretty healthy guy, at least on some fronts. He's got some outages on other fronts. But he is angry at the Philistine and the Philistines and their army and Goliath for taunting his people the way that he is. But one of the things we see in the story is we do see David surrounded by some pretty unhealthy people that are dealing with unidentified anger in their life. In fact, in 1 Samuel 17, as we looked at a few weeks ago, we see the young shepherd boy David, and he comes to the battle lines. He's basically just running lunch to his brothers. He's a young kid. He brings lunch to his brothers, and he gets bothered. He sees this giant taunting his people, and he's like, hey, who's going to stand up to this giant? Who's going to do something about this? This isn't right. And so we see righteous anger right here. And so he's just calling for somebody to step up and defend his people. Now, his older brother, Eliab, doesn't appreciate his question and calling somebody to step up. In fact, when Eliab hears this, here's what he says. It says, when Eliab, David's oldest brother, heard him speaking with the men, Eliab burned with anger at him. Now, just a quick recap, if you weren't here a few weeks ago. At this point, the young David has been anointed or identified as the next king of the nation of Israel. And so he's in development. He's not the king yet because he's just a young kid, but he's in development. And so the priest Samuel showed up and said, hey, this is the one, which means that the older brother Eliab wasn't chosen as the next king. Now, David also has developed as a fine musician. He's a poet. He's very artistic. It says he's handsome. Many times it says he's pleasant to the eye. He was fresh-faced, which means he didn't have any war wounds on his face. And he's done a great job at watching his father's sheep. And so in light of all of that, or maybe in spite of all that, he comes to the battle lines with lunch, and his oldest brother is raging with anger at him, which is interesting because this is probably anger wrongly expressed, because at least from what we read, we don't see any evidence that his brother should be angry with him, other than the fact that David got chosen as the next king instead of the oldest in the lineage. And so here's kind of a verbal picture of how this plays out. His oldest brother's like, why have you come down here, David? And with who did you leave those few little sheep in the wilderness? And so he begins belittling David. He's kind of like, hey, we're warriors down here, David. You're like nothing but a little sheep watcher. That's what you do. You just take care of a few little sheep. We're warriors. Why are you here? He says, I know how conceited you are and how wicked your heart is. I mean, notice how accusatory his language is right here. He's questioning David, and he's accusing his intentions, which is a really dangerous place to be. See, whenever you begin to question somebody's intentions, see, you really can't understand somebody's heart. I mean, only God can understand somebody's heart. So this is dangerous territory right here. He's like, you came down here only to watch the battle. And so Eliab is reframing David into who he wants to believe David is. And see, this is what anger always does. Anger always knocks people down, and we, in our own mind, reframe them into the people we want them to be. Now, what's fascinating here is David has already been chosen and anointed as the next king of the nation of Israel. And so this is where the seed of anger was planted with his older brother, when his older brother was rejected. And this is now connected to jealousy. If we look back a chapter in 1 Samuel 16, it says, but the Lord said to Samuel, who was the priest coming to identify the next king, and this is where Eliab is overlooked. It says, do not consider his appearance or his height, referring to the oldest brother, for I have rejected him. The Lord does not look at the things people look at. People look at the outward appearance, but the Lord looks at the heart. And so again, we looked at a couple weeks ago how the whole system's turned upside down right here. because Eliab probably had been like, hey, the priest is coming. One of us is going to be king. It's probably going to be me. It's always the oldest brother. So he's not only been expecting it, but he's probably been out bragging about this with his friends. And then God, through Samuel, shows up and says, nope, that's not the one. David is the one. And so Eliab feels like he's been overlooked because God says, I don't look at the things that everybody else looks at. I don't look at the stature. I don't look at the outward appearance. I look at the heart. And see, in that moment, the seed of anger is planted in Eliab's heart because he wasn't picked. And not being picked leads to things like anger. And as a result, jealousy sets in. And jealousy is an amazing thing. In fact, jealousy is a very, very difficult thing to carry because when we're jealous, all we do is we constantly compare and compete. We can't actually affirm and celebrate. And so as a result, anger gets a foothold in Eliab's life. So what do we do when we find ourselves in these places? I want to give you three things this morning. All right, three things Giglio talks about. And let me be clear as I give these to you. There's no quick fix on this. All right, when it comes to anger, there's no quick fix, but God creates change bit by bit. And the key to lasting change, and I realize we may not all be at this place yet this morning, but the key to lasting change is when we submit our lives to Jesus and his grace and his leadership and his lordship in our life. And when we take that step, which is a big step, you might need to take some baby steps before that, but when you say, God, I'm just going to submit myself to Christ's grace and his leadership in my life, little by little, we begin to see things change. Little by little, our heart begins to soften. Little by little, we begin to pray for the other person that's hurt us instead of condemning them. Little by little, we begin to see them the way Jesus sees them, not just the way we want to see them. So Giglio gives us three things on how to slay the giant of anger, all right, which Christ has already defeated. All right, so number one, here's the first one. We have to remind ourselves that we aren't perfect to begin with. All right, we have to remind ourselves that we aren't perfect. Nobody's perfect. Now, it's really helpful to do this little inventory right here. I mean, it's really good for us to identify why we're angry, all right, to know what's lurking beneath the surface. But see, here's the thing we have to remember. You're not perfect either, all right? And so you actually created somebody else's list. You've actually done things that somebody else sat, if they were here today, and would go, yep, they did that to me. All right, because you've probably offended a spouse, a child, a parent, a boss. We have to remind ourselves that somebody else is or has been angry with us. And if you have a hard time kind of connecting with that, let me take it to a deeper level. We have to realize that God is somebody who's been angry with us. Now this one's a little bit trickier to understand. All right, see, we don't like to think of God as being an angry God, or maybe some of us, it's all we think about is God as being an angry God, and he's, you know, throwing lightning bolts down at us all the time. We don't like to think of God as a God of wrath, all right? Because and one of the problems we have with this is we tend to think or look at God's wrath similar to the way you and I have wrath and anger in our lives. All right, and so, in fact, we see this beautifully and deeply and actually not very accurately portrayed in the great movie Bruce Almighty. Take a look at this.
Fine! The gloves are off, pal! Come on, let me see a little wrath. Smite me, oh mighty smiter! You're the one who should be fired! The only one around here not doing his job is you!
Smite me. What a great moment right there, right? See, sometimes we look at God's anger and wrath synonymous with human anger and wrath, and they're not the same, right? They're not the same. See, God is both loving and wrathful at the same time. He's wrathful because he's righteous. He's wrathful because he's holy, meaning he's set apart. He's wrathful because he doesn't tolerate certain things that we tolerate. He's wrathful because we let little sins creep into our life. He doesn't let little sins creep into his life, into his character. In fact, J.I. Packer puts it this way. He says, wrath is an old English word defined in my dictionary as deep, intense anger and indignation. Anger is defined as stirring of resentful displeasure and strong antagonism by a sense of injury or insult. Indignation as righteous anger aroused with injustice and baseness. Such is wrath, and wrath, the Bible tells us, is an attribute of God. And so see, God's wrath means he can't have anything to do with sin. One, because it's the antithesis of his character, and two, because it's not at his best for you and my life. Now this is so important to grasp. See, we have to have a different picture of God's wrath that's not synonymous with the way you and I express wrath and anger. Right? God's not up shaking his fists out of control. He's not up there, you know, throwing lightning bolts when somebody, you know, does something he doesn't want them to do. And yet by nature, God is a holy God, and so he has to turn away from sin. And yet there's a fierceness to him that we have to contend with, and yet his anger is positional. God's anger is positional because it refuses to be associated with sin. See, one of the ways I've come to understand God's wrath is it really got clear for me when I became a parent. Because, you know, with my kids, I have four kids, and with my kids, if they do something that puts them in a place where they may have some long-term damage or consequences for their life, they're going to experience my wrath in that moment, right? They're going to experience a little of the displeasure of their father, their earthly father. They're going to experience some of my anger. Why? It's not because I want to hurt them. It's not because I want to bring more pain to their life. It's not even because I'm vengeful and I'm like, well, how could you do that? It's because it makes me angry when they experience something that's less than the best. And see, this is how God's wrath works for us. In fact, the Apostle Paul, he puts it this way in Romans. He says, because of your stubbornness and your unrepentant heart, that means you and I, we tend to go after things that are contrary to what God's best is for us. He says, you're storing up wrath against yourself for the day of God's wrath when his righteous judgment will be revealed. And so as we think about our anger, we have to first remember that long before anybody betrayed us, long before anybody belittled us, long before anybody rejected us, we belittled and we rejected God. And yet, get this, we were forgiven. In fact, Chris Pratt, recently at the 2018 MTV Movie and TV Awards, he had this great speech where he received a reward and then he gave 9 tips to his fans. 9 tips for life, and 3 of them were just really powerful and had some spiritual content, and then the rest were just humorous. So take a look at these.
And to the fans, I wouldn't be here without you. Thank you. This being the Generation Award, I'm gonna cut to the chase and I'm gonna speak to you, the next generation, okay? I accept the responsibility as your elder, so listen up. This is what I call 9 rules from Chris Pratt, Generation Award winner. Number 1, breathe. If you don't, you'll suffocate. Number 2, you have a soul. Be careful with it. Number 3, don't be a turd. If you're strong, be a protector, and if you're smart, be a humble influencer. Strength and intelligence can be weapons, and do not wield them against the weak. That makes you a bully. Be bigger than that. Number 4, when giving a dog medicine, put the medicine in a little piece of hamburger, they won't even know they're eating medicine. Number 5, doesn't matter what it is, earn it. A good deed? Reach out to someone in pain, be of service, it feels good and it's good for your soul. Number 6, God is real. God loves you. God wants the best for you. Believe that. I do. Number 7, if you have to poop at a party, but you're embarrassed, because you're gonna stink up the bathroom, just do what I do, lock the door, sit down, get all the pee out first, okay? And then once all the pee's done, poop, flush, boom. You minimize the amount of time that the poop is touching the air, because if you poop first, it takes you longer to pee, and then you're peeing on top of it, stirring it up, the poop particles create a cloud, goes out, and then everyone in the party will know that you pooped. Just trust me, it's science. Number 8. Learn to pray. It's easy, and it's so good for your soul. And finally, number 9, nobody is perfect. People are gonna tell you you're perfect just the way you are. You're not. You are imperfect. You always will be, but there is a powerful force that designed you that way. And if you're willing to accept that, you will have grace. And grace is a gift. And like the freedom that we enjoy in this country, that grace was paid for with somebody else's blood. Do not forget it. Don't take it for granted. God bless you. Please get home safely. Thank you.
Oh, man, how awesome. You know what my favorite was in there? Poop, flush, boom. Oh, it's science, right? It just makes sense. No, but on a bigger level, nobody's perfect. Nobody's perfect, right? You've wronged, you've screwed somebody over. You've made somebody else's list. And yet, guess what? Guess what? That was bought with a price, with somebody else's blood. So we have to remind ourselves, the second thing, that God has made a peace treaty for us. How about a little Christmas in July this morning? It's actually almost July, 10 days before July. One of the more famous Christmas passages. Here's what it says about Jesus. For unto us a child is born, to us a son is given, and the government will be on his shoulders, and he will be called, and notice the descriptions right here, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, and get this one right here, Prince of Peace. Here's why this is so important. See, Jesus is coming to the negotiating table, and he's saying, I have the ability to negotiate a peace treaty on your behalf. Now, he could have come to the table and he could have said, hey, here's all the things you've done. Here's all the ways you've screwed somebody. Here's all the ways you've wronged somebody else. Here's all the ways you've wronged me. Here's all the ways you've rejected me. But he doesn't do that. He comes to the table and he says, I'm going to offer you a peace treaty. I'm going to do for you something nobody else has been able to do. I'm going to give you salvation. And how does he do this? It's through his blood. It's through the cross. I mean, this is why we celebrate the cross, why we sing songs about the cross. That song we sang earlier this morning, Forgiven, man, powerful imagery in that song. Look at these lyrics. God, I fall down to my knees with a hammer in my hand. You know what that means? That means the nails going into the hands and feet of Christ. It's like you and I were the ones pounding them in because of our transgressions. And yet he looks at us, arms open, and you know what he says? He says, forgiven, forgiven. See, Jesus did something to bring us near. In fact, the Apostle Paul, again, talks about it in Ephesians 2. He says, but now in Christ Jesus, you who were once far away have been brought near by the blood of Christ. Well, what that means is by the blood of Christ, because of what Jesus did on the cross, he negotiated a brand new deal on your behalf. And why did he do this? He goes on to talk about it in verse 15. He says, his purpose was to create in himself one new humanity out of the two. Who are the two? It's those who know God and those who don't. Those who are deserving of God, which is really no one, and those who aren't. The righteous and the unrighteous. Thus making peace and in one body to reconcile both of them to God. And how did he do this? Through the cross. You know what this means? This means God's not angry anymore. This means that all of God's anger, all of God's righteous wrath, that was settled once and for all on the cross. And so what that means is in Jesus, we find a covering. In Jesus, we find a relief that the Prince of Peace came and he negotiated a brand new peace treaty on your behalf. And if he did that on your behalf, then the third thing we're to do with our anger is that we are to forgive. And that's the only response that's appropriate, right? And here's where the application comes in. See, the Apostle Paul, I love the Apostle Paul. I've referenced him a couple times. I'm going to read one more thing. We always have to understand where the Apostle Paul came from. See, Paul wasn't always a follower of Jesus. He used to actually hate Christians. Earlier in his life, he was out to kill Christians. He was out to snuff out the first century church. And then he became one. He had all this anger and wrath toward people who were followers of Jesus. And then that love of Christ transformed his life, and he became a Christian. And so Paul gets this. All right, so here's what Paul says in his letter to the Christians in Ephesus, which is Ephesians chapter 4. He says, therefore, each of you must put off falsehood and speak truthfully to your neighbor. Why should we do this? For we are all members of one body. And then here's the money line right here. He says, in your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you are still angry. So what Paul's saying right here is if you want to experience all that God has for you, all right, you can't go to bed angry. All right, you can't go to bed without dealing with the anger in your heart. He says, you've got to
let it go. Let it go.
I got daughters at home, right? I couldn't resist that moment. But you're going to be singing that the rest of the day. And that's why I played that for you, because you've got to let it go. That's what he's saying. He's saying, you've got to let this go. You got to let it go. All right, so I want to ask you two really insensitive questions this morning, all right, as we wrap up. Now, this is why I tell you every now and then that you really don't want me as a counselor in your life. Sometimes people are like, man, I want to meet with you. I'm like, you really don't want to. All right, because I ask questions like this and you don't like to answer them. And so, you know, these are a little uncomfortable in a setting like this, but I can't see you. I'm not going to be able to see you wiggle in your seat as you answer this for yourself. So it's why we keep the lights low in this room. So two really insensitive questions. Are you ready for them? Actually, three. I'm going to give you three. The first one is this: how far into your future do you intend to carry the angst that was created in your past? Let me read that again. How far into your future do you intend to carry the angst, the anger, that was created in your past? Now, I struggle with the word angst a bit because it's not just anger. Sometimes it's anxiety and wrath and all this, this feelings of things that happen that get us all bent up and, you know, uptight. How long into your future do you continue to allow that to affect you? And you're probably going, well, I don't know. I don't have any plans. Well, see, this is why this is an important question. Because if you don't have plans at some point to drop what's happened in the past, you're going to keep carrying it. Here's another way to ask it. How long do you intend to allow the people that have mistreated you to continue to influence your future? How long? And you're probably like, well, I don't know. I've never really thought of it that way. Well, see, you need to think of it this way. I don't know if we need to get a calendar out and say, okay, how long? Like, are you going to keep carrying it for the rest of your life? Are you going to carry it until, like, you ruin another marriage? Like, how long? How long do you intend to carry the stuff that happened in the past? I mean, are you going to wait till your kids are out of your home or till you retire or till you get out of college? I mean, you have to answer that question. How long am I going to allow the people that have mistreated me to continue to influence me in the present and the future? See, we love to hang on to these things, right? You know why? Because this is our story, right? I mean, so whenever we get, you know, in a difficult situation or somebody at work's not happy with us, we can go, well, you know, I'm just having a bad day because, you know, I don't know if you know this or not, but way back somebody really, you know, screwed me over and I'm still dealing with it. And so we start telling our story. And before long, they're like taking us to dinner and they're like, oh my gosh, you need a week away at my vacation house. And they're looking at you and they're going, you know, man, if I had that happen in my life, I'd probably, you know, be screwed up just like you are. Or I mean, I'd probably be angry just like you. And so this is our story. But see, the adult question is how long, here's a third version, how long are you going to continue to empower the people that you don't even like anymore? How long are you going to let them influence your future? And if we're honest, we go, I don't think I want to empower that one more day. I don't think I want to let that person that mistreated me have power over me for one more day. I don't think I want that second grade teacher who told me I'd never amount to anything to have power over me one more day. I don't think I want those mom wounds and those dad wounds from way back, which are real, by the way. I don't want those to empower me for one more day. But the question is, how long then are you going to continue to carry it? See, forgiveness is when you say to your Heavenly Father, God, I don't want to, but I'm going to forgive them because you forgave me. Because I can't hold against them more than what you chose to not hold against me. So you have the power to do that because of what Jesus did on the cross. You have the power to forgive. And the other person may say, I don't care. Another person may say, you know, I don't even know what you're talking about. I mean, I that was all you. That wasn't me. That's totally fine. All right, they don't have to receive it. You just tell it to yourself and tell it to God. And here's what happens. When you do that, that giant stops taunting you. And remember, forgiveness is a process. So you may have to do it more than once, not because it didn't stick the first time or you weren't sincere the first time, but you might have to continue forgiving them to remind yourself that I've let it go. All right? And this doesn't mean the relationship is going to be restored and everything's going to be back to normal. You may not want a relationship restored. All right, that may never happen, but you still need to forgive them. You may not become friends with them, but see, here's the thing. You've got to let it go so the past can let go of you. Because see, here's what I think you want, and here's what I know I want, and I definitely know God wants this for us. He wants us to be able to lay our heads on our pillow at night. This is why he says, don't go to bed with anger in your heart. He wants you to be able to lay your head on your pillow at night and go, you know, that stuff that happened today or yesterday or 15 years ago, I'm not going to let that affect my future one more day. But we have to decide, how much longer into the future are you going to allow the people that have mistreated you to influence you? Now, I want to give you some super simple next steps this morning, all right? So on the back of your connection card are some next steps. You can go ahead and take that out, and I'm going to refer to a few of these. And the first one you've already done, I encourage you to complete this inventory. If you didn't complete it, take it with you. Work through this, all right? Identify which one holds the most weight, which one is the one that I really struggle with the most, and start there, all right? And then here's what you need to do. This is the next step, all right? You need to make a list of everything that person owes you. All right, this is one of the most powerful things you can do. All right, and you might be thinking, Kurt, I've already done that. I mean, I thought about what they did, and I pulled my Bible out, and I got a verse, and I got down on my knees, and I said, God, will you just forgive them? And as soon as I did that, I thought it was going to change, and nothing changed. You know why nothing changed? Because you probably forgave them generally, but you've got to forgive them specifically. All right, you need to make a list. All right, you need to make a list of everything they've done to you. You need to write it out. You need to list it out. You need to engage with that list. See, you can't pardon them for something that you don't know about. It's like saying, yes, they did take away my ability to have a healthy childhood. Yes, they did take away my ability to raise my daughter the way I wanted. Yes, they did take away my ability to have the job that I wanted. And whatever it is, you need to write it out. You need to list it out. And see, when you begin doing this is so powerful. And by the way, that list is probably going to be a lot longer than you think it's going to be, all right? It's going to be pretty long. But see, when you begin to make a list, guess what happens? The energy from your story begins to dissipate. Because once you say, hey, here's what they took away from me, and here's why I'm pissed at them, and here's why I'm angry, something powerful begins to happen inside of you. And as you look at that list, you can then go, okay, I pardon them. I forgive them. And they don't owe me anymore. And here's the bigger phrase. They don't own me anymore. And you know what else? You know what's crazy is when you look at that list, I mean, they can't repay it anyway. I mean, there's no way they can restore things on that list. But we have to decide today, how much longer are we going to let the past, the people that have mistreated us, people that have made us angry, continue to influence our future? Because when you move on and you release the past releases you. Let me pray for us. Heavenly Father, this is a hard one. Because we all, if we're really honest, have that anger lurking beneath the surface. And it comes out. I mean, we exhibit it at times. But it's that stuff underneath that we've kind of ignored. It's that stuff that happened way back when. That stuff that we just continue to allow to fester. And yet you've given us a pathway. You said, don't go to bed angry. And what you're really saying is, I care about you enough that I don't want you to let that thing influence you one more day. So, Father, I just pray that whatever you're doing in our hearts right now, whatever people have come to mind, whatever relationships we're wrestling through right now, whatever pathway you've began to form in our heart right now, God, I just pray that you will continue to work on that. Not just when we walk out of the doors, until we walk out of the doors, but God, into this week, that you would, if we need to make a list and continue making a list, that you help us to do that and bring us to that place where we can say, I pardon them, because we want to be released from the past. And because of what you did on the cross, Father, we can experience that. Because the giant of anger has fallen. And on a bigger scale, God, there may be some of us here this morning who just need to take a step to you. Maybe we've never taken the step to receive from you, to take advantage of the peace treaty that you gave us, that you created on our behalf. And so we know that's where true forgiveness begins, is when we experience it ourselves. So if there's any of us sitting here right now, and today's our day, and we just need to say, yes, Jesus, I want to know that grace, that love, that fullness in my life, it can happen for you right now by just saying yes. Jesus, I want to know that. Teach me, show me what it means to begin to follow you. And that relationship begins right there. Father, as we sing these last couple songs, I just pray that you'd remind us whose we are. Just remind us that we are your children, your adoptive sons, your adoptive daughters. Just surround us with that melody, I pray.